well for the first time. Could have went a totally different way, I think. A little housekeeping. It's not going to have anything to do with the sermon, really. But last week, I got this little gadget to hook into my phone to do nonsense with. But I had to take my phone out of its case to hook this thing in. And so I did that. But then it was late at night, and I didn't want to put my case back on. So I just set my phone. And then that next morning, it was Saturday, last Saturday, I came to do the bulletin. So I still didn't put my phone case on. And the first thing I did when I sat down at the desk, I went to put my phone on the desk, and I missed it completely. I just dropped it straight onto the floor. And I had kind of a little crack at the top, and then I had like a big crack. And it kept getting worse throughout the week. I called Verizon, and you know how that went. That was fun, right? And they sent me on to the insurance people, and that went about the same. They wanted to give me something else, and I said, I just want my phone fixed. That's all I want. So they said, go to Fayetteville, and they'll fix it for you. So Missy and I went to Fayetteville, crowded this four or five people in this little bitty shop, and I go in there, and I say, I think you have an order for my phone to be fixed. And that girl, you know, she's already had enough of people like me, and it's like 10:30 in the morning. She says, what's your name? So I tell her, and she looks it up, and she looks at my phone. She kind of looks at it funny. She holds it out, and then she takes her fingernail, and that little protective thing over my glass was still on my phone, and that's what had broke. And so she hands me my broke piece of plastic and my unbroke phone. And I said, well done. Thank you. And I turned and looked at all those people in the shop, and I nodded to them, and out the door I went. Missy said, that was quick. I said, turns out it wasn't broke. And she wasn't even surprised. She was just like, yeah, that sounds pretty, pretty right. So how'd your Saturday go, I guess is what I'm saying. Well, we're going to kind of continue our talking. When the Israelites were entering the promised land after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness during that time, the Lord, if he didn't know then, he surely found out that as humans, we were a very fickle group of creation, that we have short-term memory problems. And so God wanted them to remember how he had taken care of them in the wilderness for 40 years there. 40 years where they continued to have food and drink when they should not have had food and drink. They were things that didn't come from crops. They were not things that the Israelites got on their own accord. God, the Lord, had taken care of them over and over and over again. And so he instituted this feast called the Feast of Tabernacles. And we've talked about this a few years ago. The Feast of Tabernacles lasted for 7 days in the month of October. And you guys know how I am with calendars. And so that it happened in October. And the Israelites would come from wherever they were at, and they would come to Jerusalem, and they would live in tents, in little tabernacles as a reminder of that time when they lived in the wilderness. And so that's what they would do. They would go back and live in tents for this time of worship. Now, but by the time Jesus comes along, this festival had really became a celebration. It was not just a feast of tabernacles. It was a festival of tabernacles. And the Mishnah is a Jewish commentary on the law. A lot of rabbis during the Second Temple period, when the Jews came back from exile, they wrote a commentary on the law to sort of give everybody a guideline on what they meant. And so part of the Mishnah said that they were to set these four giant poles of about 75 feet in the four corners of the temple courtyard. And these were basically just massive candelabras. Again, they were 75 feet in tall, and they had about 10-gallon oil vats that was able to set up there at the top, and they would light those candles for the night. And they would do this for 7 days. At evening or at dusk, they would light these things up, and it would sort of be like, imagine driving in Oklahoma on a Friday night, right? You can be going down the highway, and if there's a high school football game going on within 50 miles, you can see those stadium lights, right? You know what's going on. And it was sort of like that. It was that light for them. It was something that wasn't normal. It certainly wasn't natural. They put this light on, and it would essentially light up most of the city for people. And then on the seventh day, the high priest would then lead a parade of people that would go down to the Pool of Siloam. And the Pool of Siloam, which was what Hezekiah dug the trench under to bring the water into the city of Jerusalem in the way back when. So the high priest would go, and he would take a golden pitcher, and he would scoop up water from the Pool of Siloam. And then the parade would go back to the temple, up the Temple Mount. And there he would take this golden pitcher of water, and then he would take a silver pitcher of wine, and then he would pour it out in front of the Lord and the whole community. It would be like a drink offering for God. And then the high priest would say this prayer in front of all those gathering. He would say, God in heaven, send your Messiah soon. In our days, we cry out for the light. And that's what the rabbis had done. For a long time, the rabbis had been teaching that the Messiah would be referred to as the light. They would look at passages in Isaiah 42 where God would say, Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. And then a few verses later, he says, I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. The Messiah was seen to be a light who would come into this world. Most scholars believe that it's on this seventh day of this particular feast, after the lights have been lit every night from these massive candles, and the priest has poured out the water and the wine, and he's prayed for the Messiah to come. Many scholars believe that it's in this moment that Jesus stands and says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. After all of these festivities and this light example that's going on around everybody, Jesus stands up and he says, I'm that person. I'm that light. I am the Messiah. And it's pretty powerful, I think, in that moment that Jesus uses it as an illustration, but it also uses it as a fulfillment of prophecy, that he was coming, that he has come, and that he is here. We don't just celebrate that, we don't just celebrate that one time a year in March or April, but we celebrate that every Sunday morning, right? That the risen sun is the light that darkness cannot fathom. That we know that no darkness was able to hold him, not even the darkness of a tomb. And I think the reason that's important for us is because we live in a world where not everybody's Christian. And that shouldn't surprise any of us. We live in a world where not everybody follows Jesus. We have a lot of different religions out there. There's Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam. There's a whole lot of religions. And then you have a whole bunch of people who don't really follow anything, right? Well, we might call them atheists, or we might call them agnostic. Maybe scripture sometimes just calls them lost. And sometimes that might be how they feel, like they don't know where to go. The thing is, there's a lot of people with a lot of different worldviews out there. And what makes us think that ours, that the Christian worldview, is any better than anybody else's? I mean, what right do we have to proclaim that we have this exclusive understanding of life here and life eternal? That's a really bold statement, I think. It's certainly bold if you can't back it up. And if you can't back it up, why would you ever say anything like that? I think we can back it up. Really, I think it's really been backed up for us. I think one of those pieces of evidence is all of those prophecies in Scripture. It's said that Jesus fulfilled over 300 prophecies from the Old Testament. And again, these prophecies, many were hundreds of years before Jesus shows up. Isaiah is saying he will be the light. And then Jesus shows up and he claims he's the light. And that may not seem like prophecy fulfilled until you know the rest of the story and how Jesus defeats darkness, how he truly is the light. He doesn't just make the claim. He is what he says, because I am who I am, as God would tell Moses. Jesus would probably reiterate that to us, right? All of these prophecies are all over the Old Testament, and they tell us things like where Jesus would be born, how that birth would happen, what he would do in his life, the kind of company that he would keep, his betrayal, his death, how long he would stay in the grave, and his resurrections. Of these prophecies, for a normal person to fulfill, 300 is a lot, but even a small number, even if you would take like 20 prophecies, the odds of one person fulfilling 20 prophecies is pretty astronomical. And Jesus fulfills 300. There's something amazing about that. So let's put it in another way of why that's sort of so amazing. About 500 years before Jesus, there was a man that we would call Buddha, is what we call him nowadays. He was born in Nepal, and he struggled, like a lot of us do, but he struggled with a lot of the injustices in this world, and he tried to figure out a way, and he actually did come up with some pretty impressive ideas on how to navigate the injustice of this world, and his ideas started attracting a following. And that following would become the religion we would know as Buddhism. But here's the thing. They've got some good things to say, and you gotta give them that. They have some good things to say. But nobody before Buddha ever prophesied that a guy was going to be born in Nepal and that he would teach the things that Buddha taught, that he would live the way that Buddha lived, and that he would die the way that Buddha died. And if you could find his grave today, guess what would be inside that grave? Buddha's bones, right? That was 500 years before Jesus. 500 years after Jesus, Muhammad is born in Saudi Arabia. And Muhammad thought he had a revelation from God. And so he started teaching about those revelations that he was having. And he garnered quite a following. And his teachings, of course, ended up being the basis for Islam. And we know a lot of people follow that. But the same with Buddha. Nobody ever prophesied that Muhammad was going to be born in Saudi Arabia and that he would do the things that Muhammad did or say the things that Muhammad said or die the way that Muhammad died. And if you were even allowed to go and find the grave of Muhammad, you would find his bones the same as you would find Buddha's bones. They may have some good thoughts in life, and there may be some good values to instill within other religions or other worldviews that people might have. But the thing is that all of those are maybe good options for some, but none of them are seen as the light. We can't talk about them as being the way, the truth, and the life. And we'll get to that. The exclusive claim of Jesus is important to us, because he can back it up. We've been talking about these I am statements of Jesus. Jesus makes these statements so he can back up prophecies. His life continues to show it, because Jesus was born. There were hundreds of years of prophecies that may not have made much sense to a lot of the Jews at the time. They probably had a whole lot more grace of saying there's no one that's ever going to be able to fulfill all these prophecies. And then Jesus shows up and he fulfills every one of them, and he stands before them and he says, I am the light of the world. In the introduction to John's gospel, John says that this word gave life to everything that was created. The word John using for word here is logos, and that's a connection back to Jesus. So Jesus gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone, the light that shines in the darkness, and the darkness can never extinguish it. The light always wins. But sometimes you got to be patient, right? Darkness, though it can never extinguish it, but what does that mean for us today that Jesus is the light? Because darkness can't fight with Jesus. We understand that, but what does it mean for us here today? Because we do know that Jesus conquered death. We know that he conquered the tomb and that darkness could not hold him. But what does it mean for us that Jesus says, "I am the light of the world"? Maybe the first answer to that is whenever he says that I'm the light of the world, is what he will do. Jesus' light helps us see the world the way that it is. I think sometimes we kind of get this idea amongst ourselves that we have to go around the world with rose-tinted glasses on. That as Christians, we have to see the whole world as sort of being hunky-dory, and it's all okay, and it's all fine, and nothing can really get me down because I got Jesus in my heart, right? We kind of say those things, but you don't have to look around very long to see that this world is a pretty dark place, right? Well, we can turn on the news just about any night of the week and hear about a kid getting shot at school. We can turn on the news every night of the week and read about somebody that's leading us astray on a national level. We can look at our social medias and see people who are celebrating how dark this world can really get. And we look at that and we have to admit, yeah, Lord, that this place is pretty bleak. But I think sometimes we forget how dark the world is because we've lost sight of the light. We've all gone into a dark room before, right, with no lights. But you sit in there just a little bit, and what starts to happen? Your eyes start adjusting, right? You start being able to make out some things. You start thinking, I can navigate this room pretty well. And we do the same thing with the world. We stay in the dark so long, but we can navigate it pretty well. We can say, I know how to get into the politics of this world, or I know how to get into the schools, or I know how to navigate all of these things. But the thing is that we truly are forgetting we live in a dark world. And in a dark world where that's all you know, you may not see the light because you don't have Jesus. And then you don't have the light. Paul would say in Romans chapter 3 that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And that's a way of saying that everyone is in darkness. It's another way of saying that the world is a dark place to live, and God helps us see humans are just the way we are. God is never surprised by the darkness of humanity. And I think that's maybe scary, but I don't think there's anything that human beings have ever done that God was like, I didn't see that coming. I can't believe they did that. God knows. God knows what we're capable of because he created us with those capabilities. He knows the darkness in this world. But see, his light doesn't just let the world be the way it is. Jesus' light helps us see us the way that we are too. The darkness in the world is one thing, and it's easy to say that this world it is so dark. And sometimes, quite often, if I'm going to be real honest with you all, that darkness lives in me. Believe that darkness lives in you too. That darkness taints us. That darkness makes it a little bit more easy to be comfortable with the ways of this world than it does to be comfortable with the ways of Jesus. Because Jesus is the light, and the light and darkness don't mix very well, but that darkness is within me more than I really care to admit. Paul would tell the church in Ephesus in Ephesians 2 that you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. The prince of power of the air, so some translations translate that as the devil. Have you ever thought about it that way, of understanding your sin as obeying the devil? That's how he says you used to live. He says the prince of power of air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, they live in darkness among whom we all. And that all there, it really means all, right? All of us. All of us used to live that way. No one's exempt. Nobody's perfect. We all used to live this way, following the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and we're nature, and by nature, children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. And I would love to be able to stand up here and say this is a passage, is a reflection of the way I used to be. I think all of us would love to be able to say that. But I know I live that passage out sometimes currently, and I definitely will again, because against my best efforts and against my faith and my desire to do what is right, I still let the darkness in. And it's because so many times I'm just much more comfortable with the darkness than I am with the light. But Jesus is the light of the world, and I want to be with Jesus. So that means I have to start letting the light in more than I do the darkness. Because the darkness, when it's left unchecked, that can get overwhelming sometimes, can't it? Darkness can be overwhelming. Every single one of us that's of a certain age knows. We know how overwhelming darkness can be. And we might come to a point where we think there's no way I can be forgiven for the things that I've done, that Jesus would be so ashamed if he knew all the things I've done. That darkness closes in, and that can be a scary place. And we let that shame come back, and we think that Jesus would be ashamed of us if Jesus knew everything that was going on. But I'll let you in on a little secret that I forget a lot of times. It's really not much of a secret. God already knows, right? God already knows who you are. God already knows how the darkness is within you. And here's the kicker. He still loves you. He still sent his son to die on the cross for you. But that's not the end of the story. He sent his son to die on a cross for you, and his son is raised from the dead for you so that you can be raised from the darkness of the tomb, that you don't have to live in darkness. It's never too late. Jesus would say in John 12:46 that I have come into the world as light so that whoever believes in me will not remain in darkness. And we can feel like this world is a dark place, and we can feel like our lives are in a really dark place. But Jesus says he has come not just to bring light, but to bring light so that we don't have to be in darkness anymore ever again. And I think that's the beauty of what we celebrate every week in the Lord's Supper, where we celebrate the light breaking through on that third day. That first day of the week where the women would come that morning to the tomb, and they were in mourning, right? And they leave with hope. Maybe a little bit of confusion that day, but they leave with hope. Because the light had broke. The light had broke that tomb. And the angel that rolled the stone away sat upon that stone. And the Bible says that he was even being described with a radiant light. And I think that's because when Jesus is around, when Jesus is there, there is light. And there will always be light. But you may think, not for me. Not all of the things I've done. It's too late for me. I'm just coming to church because I'm honoring some family members, or I'm too dark, I'm too lost, I'm too far gone. And we all know there was a guy who absolutely hated Christians. He would persecute the church at every opportunity. He was responsible, that we know of for sure, of at least one preacher. And then in Acts 9, it says that as they were approaching Damascus on the mission, that a bright light shined there. And Paul was saved. Saul becomes Paul. Jesus literally reveals himself to Saul. And then he's blinded by the light, and Saul's life is changed forever. He didn't realize that he was living in darkness for so long. He thought his religious zeal was fine, more than fine. He thought he was great with God. And then God shows up and shows him how dark his world really was. And it changed his life so much that he would write basically half of our New Testament to share that light with us. He would tell the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 4:6, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." And as Christians, we have that light shining in our hearts. We don't just remember Jesus coming and living this wonderful life and dying for us and being in the grave for 3 days to rise again. That's a wonderful story in and of itself, but that's not the full story, right? The full story is whenever the light of Christ rose from that grave, he breathed the light into the disciples and said, "Go on and keep shining. Wherever you go, let that light shine." Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," but in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "You are the light of the world too." And the only way you can be the light of the world and Jesus can be the light of the world is if Jesus is in us and working through us and shining through everything that we do. I'm not going to lead it, but I think the best idea comes from that kid's song, "This Little Light of Mine." And you know how it goes. We're going to let that little light shine. We're not going to let Satan blow it out. We're not going to hide it under a bush, right? We're going to let it shine all around the neighborhood. And the truth about that song is that every one of us has that light. And it's not by our own glory that we have the light. That the only reason that we have the light is because of the light of the world came into our lives and he broke through the darkness of what I'm holding in as my own reality. He broke through the darkness and said no more. But the truth is, as we finish up, is I can hold that light in, right? And eventually the darkness will engulf it and overwhelm it because I've pushed that light out. And the only way that the light continues to shine is whenever I let it shine through me. That I let this little light of mine shine all around the neighborhood to shine no matter what Satan may try to do. That I'm not ever going to hide it away because Jesus rose from the dead for us. So this morning, I guess if you need prayers, we've came to this time. If you need prayers, if you need conversation about what it means to let Jesus shine on in your heart and let your life, or you need maybe to know a little bit more understanding of what it means to give your life to Jesus, to be baptized into his name, to be risen up to walk in the newness of life. Whatever your need may be, we have an invitation ready. Please come as together we stand and we sing.